In sports, Iraqi athletes will not be allowed to compete in next month's Beijing Games. The International Olympic Committee has upheld a ban on Iraqi teams, saying the government missed the deadline to address accusations of political interference. In May, the government dissolved the National Olympic Committee. Among the claims was that it was illegitimate because it lacked a legal quorum. Four members of the committee were kidnapped 2 years ago. Their fates are unknown. Five Iraqi athletes were expected to compete this year. Their places will be offered to athletes from other countries. There's word that the U.S. swimmer Jessica Hardy has tested positive for a banned substance and has just 2 weeks to pursue any appeals before the Olympics. A person familiar with the test results told the Associated Press the banned substance was a stimulant but did not provide any other details. The Chicago Cubs hope the confines of Wrigley Field are a lot friendlier than the road was when they open a three-game series tonight at Wrigley Field against the Florida Marlins. The Cubs avoided a three-game sweep by the Arizona Diamondbacks last night with a 10-6 win, but they've dropped four of their last six games all on the road. The St. Louis Cardinals hope to win the final game in a four-game series today, but they'll have to beat the hottest team in baseball to do it. Last night, the Brewers beat the Cards for the third straight time. The White Sox head to Detroit on a high note thanks to a come-from-behind 10-8 win over the Texas Rangers yesterday at U.S. Cellular Field. Tomorrow they play the first game of a big road trip. After three games in Detroit, the Sox head to Minnesota for a series against the Twins. And Marcus Burkhardt of Germany won the 18th stage of the Tour de France as the race left the Alps. Spain's Carlos Sastre managed to maintain his overall lead of 1 minute 24 seconds over CSE teammate Frank Schleck of Luxembourg. That's a look at sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, dedicated to defining spaces, creating places, and enhancing communities across the Midwest. On the web at ratioarchitects.com.
The theory behind representative government is that officials are elected to do just that, represent their constituents. Part of a state representative's job takes place at home, where they attend local meetings, resolve disputes, and help those who need it access government programs. But another part of the job involves showing up at the state capitol, introducing bills and voting on legislation that could affect their districts. It's rare for officials to neglect these duties, but as Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky reports, it does happen.
When the Illinois House earlier this month held a special session to deal with cuts to the state budget, many attempts to override the governor failed because too many lawmakers were absent. Representative Frank Martino, a LaSalle County Democrat, says it's disrespectful.
I think any time we're in session, the members should be here. That's what we're paid to do.
One of the legislators who didn't make it to Springfield was Rich Bradley, who's represented the 40th District in Chicago since 1997.
The House will be in order.
It's not the only time Bradley's missed session this year.
Roll call for attendance. Representative Curry.
Thank you, Speaker. Please let the record reflect that Representatives Duncan, Gordon, Washington, and Rich Bradley are excused today.
Bradley's missed 38 of the 48 days the House has been in session since February. That's when he lost a primary race for a seat in the state Senate. He'd basically been forced out of his House spot after a tangled tango involving some of Illinois' most politically connected families. The governor's sister-in-law and the daughter of a powerful Chicago alderman, Deborah Mell, decided to make a bid for Bradley's seat. Rather than fight her, Bradley instead challenged the district's incumbent senator, Iris Martinez. Martinez says things got nasty.
And became a very personal fight.
Martinez ended up defeating Bradley by well over 2,000 votes. Ever since, Bradley's been a rare sight around the Capitol. Deborah Mell, who was uncontested in the Democratic primary for Bradley's longtime House position, is widely expected to win the general election for it. Mell says it's an outrage and has a list of local issues she says Bradley has ignored for too long. Local voters are upset about Bradley's attendance record as well, including a Mell supporter, activist Nick Carusi. He started a petition campaign asking Bradley to step down.
He's been a silent voice, you know. He only whispered before, and now he doesn't even show up. So he shouldn't be able to finish his term. He should just resign.
One theory on why Bradley's been missing in action is money. Even if he isn't on the floor for votes, Bradley still draws an annual $75,000 salary from the state. But Bradley has another job as well. He's an assistant general superintendent for the city of Chicago's Streets and Sanitation Department, for which he earns around $100,000. State law won't allow him to be paid for that Chicago job on days he's at the Capitol. But by skipping out on session, Bradley is paid for both. Getting Representative Bradley's take on the situation was difficult. Not only was he not around the statehouse to question in person, but he didn't return more than a dozen messages left at his Capitol, District, and City of Chicago offices. Then, at the end of May, Bradley showed up for crucial House votes on the budget. At the time, he'd only been at three of the House's 28 meetings. When asked where he'd been, Bradley said he had commitments to take care of at home.
Can you elaborate at all?
No, I won't.
Do you feel as if that's fair to your constituents who, you know, elected you to be here?
Well, I've been here. I'm here for the budget votes. And again, many of the votes are mainstream Democratic issues, which pass with overwhelming support.
When prodded further about his attendance record, Bradley added that it's harder to manage his diabetes in Springfield, as he has less time to exercise and sleep. Although Bradley passed no legislation, he says he's comfortable with what he accomplished this year. According to the spokesman for the House Speaker, Bradley needs no reason. It's not like missing school, where only certain reasons qualify for an excused absence. If a lawmaker says he won't be at session, the excuse comes automatically. The Better Government Association's Jay Stewart says it's the public that loses.
The concerns and issues in his district don't hinge on his political future. They exist independent of that.
Other members have missed session days, too. In recent years, one representative was stricken with a serious illness and was out for weeks. Another's currently on National Guard duty in Iraq. In those situations, Stewart says he's sympathetic. And it's not just in state government. Illinois' junior senator Barack Obama has missed a slew of votes since his campaign for president began, as has his presumptive opponent, John McCain. Stewart says that, too, can be viewed as legitimate. But Stewart says to blatantly skip legislative sessions for no apparent reason is entirely inexcusable. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
One of the biggest disasters caused by the flood of 2008 happened in Gulfport, Illinois. That's where a levee gave way, allowing the Mississippi River to swamp the town, a major highway, and thousands of acres of farmland. It happened more than 1 month ago, but as Illinois Public Radio's Rich Egger tells us, the problems are far from over.
You can still see signs of the flood as you drive west on Highway 34 in Henderson County. A couple miles from the Mississippi, homes and grain silos are surrounded by water. Closer to the river, what was once farmland now looks like a lake. A portion of the highway is reduced to a single lane shared by each direction of traffic. The road was elevated here using gravel and stones held in place by concrete barriers. Floodwaters are just inches from the road, and they still cover the entire town. Ramps into Gulfport are closed, but on one of those ramps sits a trailer with a generator next to it. The trailer serves as office space for the crews that are now trying to remove floodwaters. Dewatering is the term used by project manager Paul Williams.
Yes, to dewater Gulfport. We're trying to get the water out of Gulfport so citizens can come back in here and look at what's left of their property.
Williams is working with the firm Ready Management Support. The Florida-based company helps with emergency recovery efforts. For example, Williams says he's worked on projects after hurricanes, including Katrina.
The big difference when you talk about the size of a project, the big difference is in a hurricane, you'll get a surge of water, which happened in that case, off the Gulf, that did all the damage, 25 to 28 feet in some areas, and then in a matter of hours, practically, it washes back out to sea. In a flood like this, that is inside of a basin that's designed to keep out water, it also obviously has the capability of keeping water in.
In Illinois, right at the bridge, if you look off to the right, you can see and you can certainly hear these huge orange and black pumps. There's 36 of them. And they're pumping 72 to 75 million gallons of water back into the Mississippi every day.
We're just kind of fighting it until the river goes back down. Then that'll happen.
But it might not happen anytime soon. While it sounds as if a great deal of water is being removed, it's just a drop in the bucket.
From about 7 o'clock last night until about 9 o'clock this morning, we'd gone down an inch. And an inch in this big a pool is a lot of water.
How big is that pool? Williams was told an estimated 8 billion gallons of water covered Gulfport. Some factors are slowing down the dewatering. The damaged levee still needs to be repaired. Other levees and elevated train tracks are holding in water. Plus, there have been heavy rainfalls the past few weeks. Williams says sometimes the water level rises instead of falling. The dewatering job itself is a challenge. It's also tough when Gulfport residents stop by and point out their homes.
And, of course, we can't let them stay here because we're a construction site, but certainly you have to have a lot of empathy for the people that have lost an awful lot at this point.
All of the homes remain in water. Some roofs contain debris clearly deposited by floodwaters. Cars and pickup trucks are at least half submerged. A muddy grime covers everything. The great flood of 2008 has receded from headlines, but the story continues for the 200 people who live in Gulfport. No one knows when they can return home or if there will be a home for them to return to. Rich Egger reporting.
It's 2:52. American drivers hate getting stuck, in traffic jams. They don't get much sympathy, though, from railroad engineers. They have traffic jams of their own. There's one place in particular where the trains run so slowly, it can take a day to move a train just a few miles. One company tried to buy its way out of the problem. Reporter Sean Ali explains how that blew up into a fight all of us might have to pay for.
If you buy a new car or build a new house, there's a good chance all that stuff to build it sat in a Chicago-area rail yard for a while. Railroads from the East Coast, the West Coast, the South, and Canada all converge there. Trains in Chicago compete for tracks, so they practically crawl. Canadian National Railway doesn't like it, and PR guy Jim Kadera says no one in America should like it either.
Everything anybody eats, drinks, wears, lives in, moved by rail, one point or another in this production chain. If we as a transportation provider can afford a better service for our customers, ultimately that contains a cost structure with the ultimate beneficiary being the consumer.
Kadera says Canadian National has a fix. It would buy a competing rail line that runs a loop around Chicago. The company would shift trains to that less congested track. The deal needs federal approval, but before that happens, Chicago-area towns are fighting over it. Those along the current route tell horror stories of living with too many trains. But suburbs along the proposed bypass route don't want those hassles in their towns. One place that would benefit by train traffic moving away is South Holland. Mayor Don DeGraff says a quick car ride shows why he supports the deal.
We're approaching an intersection where it's not at all unusual where we have a train blockage.
I was going to say, speak of the devil, look right up ahead.
It's right up in front of us, and this is a daily occurrence.
I mean, it's not moving.
No, it's just standing there. And the reason is very simple. There's no place for these trains to go.
DeGraff says inconvenience is the least of his worries.
It becomes almost like a Bermuda Triangle, where you can't go from one side of the town to the other side of the town, so we rely on a neighboring community to provide us with some additional fire protection for situations like we're experiencing right now, where a train is blocking the crossing.
South Holland is just one of 66 towns that could benefit from Canadian National's buyout of the bypass route. But dozens of towns are fighting the deal. One of those is Frankfort. Frankfort gets just a trickle of rail traffic, but it might get four times as many trains going through town. Resident Ken Gillette's backyard is right next to the bypass route.
Here I buy a house out here, and 10 months later, this is going to go through. And I had actually told my wife she wanted the house, and I says, no, one day those tracks could be sold, and there'd be, you know, hundreds of trains going by there every week. And sure enough, that's what happened.
Did you guys have some serious discussions after that?
Oh, yeah. Not good ones, you know.
Other Frankfort residents have similar stories. It's little wonder the town wants the government to stop Canadian National's buyout deal. But Mayor Jim Holland says Frankfurt is not just being selfish. He says suburbs will want protection from traffic hazards, and Canadian National is offering to pay a fraction of the cost.
It's assumed that the American taxpayer will eventually have to pay for the overpasses, the extra gates and such that will be put on the railroad. And this is mostly United States tax dollars that pay for those.
There's no perfect ending to Chicago's rail traffic mess. Even when companies like Canadian National want to fix the problem themselves, everyone pays. We'll likely pay to soften the blow to towns that will see more trains passing through. But we also pay higher transportation costs if too many trains sit idle. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Alvey.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, it took him 15 years to make his new album. He brought together top singers and musicians from around the globe to make a record in their spare time. Big Blue Ball from Peter Gabriel. That story in the day's news coming up on The World this afternoon at 3. You can also hear the program Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. here on AM 580.
Earth and Sky.
I'm Deborah Bird. Most experts now agree that we're all influenced by a combination of both genetics and environment in our development. Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson spoke with Dr. Jay Geed, a neuroscientist at the National Institute of Mental Health, about lingering questions on nature versus nurture.
Dr. Geed told me that genetics provides the outline of who we are, but our environment determines what we become. He said it's clear that people can change and adapt far into their lives. He and other neuroscientists say that, although growth and change might seem more obvious when you're younger, you're always changing. Sometimes your genes are in control, and other times it's the environment.
So that's good news, right? We always have the potential to grow and change, but maybe it's complicated to study?
Actually, it's the kind of thing that excites neuroscientists. Now, Geed says they're looking to answer questions about what genes are important at what times and which mechanisms are responsible for changes in the brain.
Did he say why this is so important?
He said that if we can understand how the brain is built, we can understand how to intervene when the brain has problems, social or medical. And now neuroscientists are getting closer to identifying the parts of the brain that matter most.
Thanks, Lindsay. This is Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.com.